This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Martha Rosenstein. Many of us use sports, the outdoors, and being active for the physical benefits. But what about the mental benefits? Physical activity has been shown to benefit your mental state, whether or not you struggle with things like depression, anxiety, mood disorders, or addiction. Many of us also intuitively know that being in nature makes us feel good. Our intuition happens to be backed up by a large and growing body of research showing that nature benefits us in many ways. It reduces stress, improves mood, reduces blood pressure, and decreases your heart rate. This week, I'm talking with people who use being in the outdoors and being physically active in a variety of different ways that benefits both their health and their mental state. In the first segment, we talk about the role physical activity can play in managing chronic illness and how your performance is more than just a measure of your fitness. It can also serve as a way to assess your current health status. In the second segment, we talk about how the outdoors and nature can help you navigate the grieving process. And in the last segment, we talk about what science says about the benefits of nature and exercise on mental health, as well as some of the challenges involved in going from being a competitive athlete to a recreational athlete because of health issues. Just a quick reminder that it's always best to check with your healthcare provider before starting any sort of exercise routine, especially if you have any chronic illness or condition. And nothing that we talk about in this show should be considered a substitute for professional medical advice. Stay tuned for more Outdoor Explorer. This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. For our first segment today, I'm talking with Leslie Need. I asked Leslie if she would be on the show because she's someone who has two chronic illnesses, but most people would have absolutely no idea that's something that's part of her life. And I think a lot of us tend to be held back by what we perceive as barriers or obstacles. In reality, that's just the story we tell ourselves. Leslie is an athlete, and she and her family are always off on some amazing adventure. Like, I think that she's just gotten back from a trip to Joshua Tree. And it's my hope that hearing a little bit more about how she manages her illnesses by being active and doesn't let them hold her back will inspire others to get outside. Thanks for being here today, Leslie.
Sure, Martha. Thanks.
Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a Midwestern girl. I grew up in Kansas. Went to school in the Midwest and then moved up to Alaska after grad school. So it's a lot more fun to play here than where I grew up.
And how did you end up in Alaska?
Work, but mostly it was work disguised because we wanted to be up here where we could be outside playing in the sun, the snow, fishing, hiking, biking, you know, skiing.
Things that are more fun here than in Kansas.
That's right.
There's not a lot of skiing in Kansas.
Very little.
Can you talk briefly about having a chronic lung issue as well as type 1 diabetes?
Sure. I've had lung issues since I was born. It was something that I've had all my life. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was in college, so that's something that's a little bit more recent. But it's always been sort of a part of my routine, taking medicine and managing my day-to-day. Something my parents modeled really well with typical everyday routines and good healthy behaviors.
I think most people are at least vaguely familiar with diabetes. The differentiating factor between type 1, which is what you have, and type 2 is that in type 1, your body simply doesn't produce insulin, which we need to regulate our blood sugar. And in type 2, your body doesn't use insulin properly, but you still have it, or you still make it. And as far as chronic lung issues goes, there are a lot of concerns there. Breathing being one of them.
Right.
Making sure that you have enough oxygen being probably, those are the biggest things. But there's also a higher risk for an infection and some potential issues with other organs as well. So related to activity, have you always been an active person? Obviously, you moved up to Alaska because you liked being active, but was that something that your parents encouraged you to do growing up, or was that something that you discovered later on in life?
You know, when I think about that, I'm sure my parents were very intentional about what we did day to day. It didn't seem that way. It seemed pretty natural. We grew up playing soccer and kids' rec leagues, basketball rec leagues, swimming in the summer. And I know for them that was something that they looked into and were very careful to plan to make sure that we were doing things that were, my sister and I were doing things that kept us active and healthy. It seemed super natural and unplanned to me. But that behavior sort of set the course for later in life when I was choosing my own schedule during the day and what to do in college and afterwards. And so it became more intentional on my part after I left the house.
And I guess I never considered this, but how did you discover that you liked to ski if you grew up in Kansas where there is no skiing?
I think there's some photo of me when I was two or three while my parents were hitting the slopes in Colorado at some sort of day school learning how to do the railroad tracks and pizza.
Pizza.
You know, right? But Most of my ski learning came in middle school when we would do youth group trips to Colorado, so it was pretty sparse skiing until we moved up here in 2007.
Great. Now, I would obviously never wish any sort of chronic health condition on anyone, but I think that kids who are diagnosed with this type of illness tend to not see it as a limitation, and it doesn't hold them back. It's just something that they live with, and a lot of the time, they don't even know what life is like without it. Whereas when you find out as an adult that you have any sort of illness, it can feel really limiting. And I've seen it keep a lot of people from doing many things that they wanted to do. And not necessarily because the illness itself is limiting them, but their perception of how the illness affects them is what causes the limitation. But kids just don't seem to feel or understand those limits in the same way. You are also somewhat of a modern medical miracle because it wasn't all that long ago that kids who were diagnosed with similar conditions just didn't get the chance to be adults. Can you share a little bit about what goes into managing these diseases on a daily basis? Because when I think about all of the things that you have to do, it makes me realize that most of us have no excuses not to go out and get some exercise or to go on our next adventure.
Well, I just want to say a couple of things. One, I think you're absolutely right that when you become conditioned to manage anything, it's a lot easier than when something new is interjected into your life. I mean, that's true with a puppy or a baby or any, you know, right. It changes your routine. And so I did grow up managing medication. It wasn't at all mysterious for me to go to the pick up a prescription or go to the doctor. I think that's something most folks don't look and deal with until they have some sort of chronic issue or acute issue that comes up later in life. And that is a nice thing about growing up with that integrated into your daily routine. It's not as scary. Day to day, you know, just I'm a pretty type A person. So I think about the most efficient use of my time and I try to do any breathing treatments that I have to do while I'm doing other things like drying my hair or if there's something I can do while I'm sitting at my desk at work or used to be if there was something I could do while I was doing homework, I'd try to squeeze it in that way. But, you know, stuff is pretty typical and routine based. People take vitamins in the morning with their coffee. You know, that's when I take most of my medication. So it becomes a lot easier once it becomes a part of a daily routine.
And creating habits is hard. It's much easier when you're younger to create good habits. But creating habits as an adult is very hard. So it's intimidating, I think, for a lot of people who suddenly have this thing that they have to deal with. But if you can, like you said, incorporate it into what you're already doing, I think that that makes it much more manageable.
Well, I know that probably you, Martha, have a calendar where you keep track of all of your workouts, the things that you're doing or supposed to be doing to get ready for your next race. And I do a pretty similar thing with both my exercise and medication, especially something new that you're liable to forget. I tend to start that with a list and then it works into your memory and it's a lot easier.
Yeah. I know, like you said, that all of this is routine for you, but how do you handle all of these things when you're out of your routine, like when you're traveling or when you're out running a marathon?
Yeah. Well, if you're talking about travel, a lot of packing lists that I make, but sort of day-to-day managing exercise when I'm out doing something like doing a marathon or a long hike, I just think through all the scenarios where I might need backup. And I take a lot of stuff. I have a big backpack I carry when I hike. My husband likes to joke about all the extra things I take with me when we travel, but it makes me feel better to know that I've got contingency plans covered.
And you have a pretty awesome fanny pack that you use when you run.
Luckily, I think it's coming back.
Excellent. We all know that whether we like it or not, exercise is good for us and that being active will help us live longer and healthier lives. It's something that I encourage all of my patients to do in a way that's both enjoyable and sustainable for them because it has so many benefits. And those benefits are not just limited to having a regular exercise or training schedule, but also to just being active in general. But I also think that a lot of people, especially those who do have chronic health conditions, don't feel like they can or should go out and, say, run a marathon. And while you certainly need to have a discussion with your healthcare provider before you decide to do something like that, I am of the belief that if you truly wanted to run a marathon, even though you had, say, a chronic lung condition or whatever the case may be, that you can. It, again, I think it comes back more to the perception of your limitations versus the actual limitations. So how does being active play a role in how you manage your condition?
One of the things that's nice about exercise, first of all, it just makes you feel good. It makes any person feel good. It's great for mental health in that way. I also think it's really helpful to serve as a little bit of a barometer of health between doctor's visits. Nobody wants to or could practically spend all the time in their doctor's office that they would need to manage health every day. But when I go out for a jog or a swim or a bike or a ski, if I feel the same way I felt last week, that's a pretty good indication that things are staying good and status quo. If I feel a little off, if I'm more fatigued, if my blood sugar is all wacky, those are indications that maybe I should make an appointment with my doctor before my next regularly scheduled appointment. So I find it really helpful in a much less intense way than going into the doctor's office to sort of monitor day to day, week to week, over time, how I'm feeling. You know, if you're doing the same race or a race at the same distance or the same hike in the summer and it feels worse than it did 2 years ago, that tells you something. Maybe it tells you that it's really cold and windy, but maybe it tells you if the conditions are the same, that something's changed. I find that to be a helpful way to sort of monitor what's been going on.
So it also sounds like there are some unique opportunities from pharmaceutical companies and medical equipment manufacturers in finding grants to help pay for equipment and training that we were just briefly talking about before we started recording.
Yeah, so I've had some pretty good luck in finding either nonprofits that are patient advocacy groups or support groups or medical companies that will provide some level of funding for activities. For example, I was able to find a nonprofit that provided grants to adults and youth for sports activities that helped partially fund some triathlon training I did. I know that there are organizations that will either fund or waive a part of a fee for you to enter races. I think Medtronic does some sponsorship around some marathons that athletes with diabetes can enter and either get fee waivers or run on a sponsored team. So I think that's happening more and more. It's probably part of the pharmaceutical and medical industry's effort to be more patient and public friendly, but that's okay. We can take advantage of that. So I think there's a lot of both condition specific and then just general population opportunities to participate in events, get some help with paying for all these exciting things that we want to do.
I think that's great too. Because pharmaceutical companies, while I mean, I have mixed opinions on them, obviously they save lives, but I think it's probably a good way for them to give back to the people who need it the most, truly. I mean, physical fitness and being active is important to anybody's life, but I think it's obviously more important to those people who are dealing with chronic or any sort of health condition. So I think that's great.
It also, I think, can be a good forum for feedback from patients and users. If you're particularly with related to medical equipment, if you're participating in some sort of program where you're using that device while being very active and you have feedback about how that could be better used, I think that's a good way to get the ear of people in PR in those industries to maybe help get your questions, concerns processed a little bit faster when they might otherwise not be heard.
I was just listening to a podcast with a physician who is really into biohacking, and he's not diabetic, but he has a continuous glucose monitor. And somebody asked him if they were going to come out with some sort of, you know, consume a version that's less expensive for people who don't have diabetes to maybe measure their blood sugar, because that does tell us a lot about health in general and, mm-hmm. You know, kind of helps you drive what you're eating more specifically. But he was like, you don't want that from them, because you as a healthcare provider, you want those things to be incredibly accurate, and you don't want them to come out with a cheaper model that then all of your patients with diabetes are going to go out and get. So I think that that's, you know, it's interesting how all of that works. So I am always excited for Leslie to go off on another adventure, because she's got some really great stories, a lot of which are stories that are only great after the fact. But could you share with us maybe what your favorite Alaskan adventure has been so far?
Well, first I'll say that, like everybody who lives in the state, probably your list of things to do gets longer every year and not shorter. I've had great experiences traveling around the state and doing all sorts of fun things. My husband and I got the opportunity to spend a week on Walrus Island outside of Togiak a couple years ago in Bristol Bay, and it was a beautiful sunny week of 70 degrees and gorgeous blue skies. That's pretty unique. We've had some great hikes up on Kasugi Ridge. One day we hiked up in the fog and woke up the next morning to a brilliant Denali. And that's always great, especially when it's coupled with sore muscles and good exercise, I think. So those are some highlights that come to mind. I was thinking about a lot of my adventures and how closely they are tied to sunshine. So maybe that says something about me yearning for some warmth. But I had some great opportunities to spend a lot of time on our feet and on bikes around the state, and that's always exciting and fun.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate you talking to me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. For our next segment, I am joined by Jean Moran. Jean and I met a few years ago in the swim and run groups that we participate in, and I have come to know her as someone who enjoys the outdoors for fun and who also enjoys participation in an organized competition or race. But like me, it's more of just a personal challenge, and we're not really in it to win it. So thanks for being here with me today, Jean.
Thank you, Martha.
In this segment, we're going to be talking about the loss of loved ones and the grieving process. And I just want to mention that how you experience grief and that the way that you move through the grieving process is very individual and a different experience for everyone. So nothing we talk about here is meant to suggest that there is a right or wrong way to go about this process. So, Jean, why don't you tell us how you found your way to Alaska first?
I was in the Navy, and they gave me a piece of paper that said, "You're going to Alaska."
Well, that seems pretty straightforward.
Actually, I requested it, too.
What made you request it?
I wanted to be up in a better place than Florida.
Oh, yeah.
More challenges and prettier.
Definitely.
And he'll work.
So there's a large and growing body of research that shows that both our mental health and our physical health is positively impacted by spending time in nature, which I think a lot of us know instinctively. And then here we are living in cities and buildings with very little connection to the outdoors. I recently read that people who live in cities have a 20% higher risk for anxiety disorders and a 40% higher risk for mood disorders compared to those who live in rural areas. Now, we definitely have more of a connection to the outdoors living in Alaska, but I think that especially in the winter, it's hard to find the time, the energy, and the daylight to get outside, even if you know that it's good for you. Have you always been somebody who enjoyed playing in the outdoors?
Absolutely.
I mean,
I grew up in a time where you got sent outside to play.
I did too, but we grew up in different times. And obviously, if you requested to come to Alaska because it was prettier, the outdoors is important to you.
It's very important. I like to play.
That's great. I think play is also something that's undervalued in our society today.
Yes.
What role did the outdoors play in your relationship with your husband?
Well, we met in an alley in downtown Anchorage in February in the middle of the night. So that kind of tells you neither of us were really hesitant about being outside in any circumstances.
That sounds like quite the interesting story. What was it something that you guys always enjoyed together? Like, did you always go play in the outdoors together?
Oh, yeah. We love being outside. One of our first dates was going to look at boats and going exploring down around Seward. So that kind of set the tone. If we were doing something, it was outside.
That's awesome. And what a great first date.
Yeah.
Or almost first date.
Almost first date.
What sort of activities did you guys enjoy most together?
Well, Ron's big thing was looking at boats. So a lot of our things revolved around water and boats. But through the years, we kind of refined it to camping and looking at boats.
Just looking at boats?
Little riding. We owned a couple small ones, but it was mostly looking.
It's cheaper that way.
Much cheaper. And then charter one and let somebody else do the maintenance.
Seems like a good philosophy. I also recently read an interesting study. I read a lot of studies in case anybody hasn't figured that out yet, that looked at the effects of nature specifically on mental health. There were two groups of participants, both who walked for 90 minutes every day, one in a park where there were lots of trees and the other next to a busy road. The researchers then measured heart rate, respiratory rates, looked at brain activity, and had participants fill out questionnaires. They found that there was not a huge difference in the physiological markers, so heart and respiratory rate, between the two groups, but there was a huge difference in their brains, specifically in the area of the prefrontal cortex, which is active during something called rumination, which is repetitive thought focused on negative emotions. The activity in this area of the brain was decreased in the group who walked in nature compared to the group who walked next to the road. So this is really interesting because it shows that nature makes us feel better, which I think a lot of us know instinctively. And there's also a lot of evidence about the effect of exercise on mood in general. And some studies even indicate that exercise may be just as effective or more effective in treating mild to moderate depression, which I think is pretty incredible. So what role has nature and being outside played in your grieving process after losing your husband?
So being that I grew up being outside all the time, and that was kind of always my therapy. If I was mad as a child, I'd just grab my bike and go for a ride. Now I've got friends who make me go out and hike with them. It doesn't take much effort. It just depends if I want to get out from under my blanket where I tend to hide. Just yesterday we were out, no, Sunday we were out for a hike on a beautiful day, and it was great. I enjoyed being with my friends, and they also are very tolerant of my lack of conversation some days. But what they don't know, at night, I go out walking in my neighborhood a lot. It's dark. I can just kind of flush it all out.
I think that's really, really great, and I
definitely identify with the going outside in the dark part.
Oh, that's the best.
I love the constant daylight of the summer, but there is something to be said for going outside when it's cold and dark.
And quiet.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate I live in a quiet neighborhood. If I don't feel like going for a walk, some nights you might find me and my cat sitting in the carport in a chair in the dark.
That's great. That's great. When I lost my mom, I found myself spending more time doing the things that she liked to do and in the places where I remember going with her. And that I knew were important to her because it kind of felt like we were spending time together. Do you feel closer to Ron in a way when you visit places you went or do activities that you used to do together?
Absolutely. But since he passed away last summer, I've been a little occupied with work, so I didn't get to do a whole lot. This summer, I'm hoping to do more, and the first places I want to do is go to places that we always enjoyed camping. Captain Cook State Park was one of our number one. King Mountain Recreation Center, or recreation area. So that's kind of my plans this summer, is just to get out and go places where we've been and do things I enjoy. And if my friends want to join me, great. I don't need to be solitary.
Great.
We just went to good places, and I like to go back.
Yeah, that's great. When I think of the role that the outdoors plays in my own life, and I see that it's a place for me to be kind of, as you described, both alone with my thoughts and feel close to those that I've lost, but also as a place where I connect with the people who care about me and remember that I'm part of a community. Because when you lose a loved one, I think it's really easy to just hole up under your blanket, isolate yourself, and not talk to anybody. So that community aspect is really important. You did mention going hiking with your friends and kind of having a good mix of being outside alone and also being outside with others.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I get the same thing when I go swimming, because I'm with my friends who are swimming, but you can be very solitary when you're in a pool. No matter how many people are in there, you just kind of wrap yourself up in your head and off you go. Plus, the water's so good for you.
True. So what has been your favorite Alaskan adventure that you've gone on so far?
Well, I've been here 25 years, so there's been quite a few. Probably one of the funniest ones was the first time we went boating together. We took my canoe out on the river, on the Gulcana. We took a bunch of guys out, and Ron and I were in the canoe. We were out for a couple days, and we ran the canoe up on a flat rock in the river, and I turned around and looked at him, and he said, "Jump!" I looked at him like he was nuts, and he goes, no, grab onto the gunwales and bounce, get off the thing. Oh, okay. So we got off the rock, and he kind of realized right then that I wasn't just going to do what he said just because he said it. He was in for a challenge with me.
That's funny. Did that go on to define your relationship?
Yeah. It worked both ways, though.
Perfect. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking time to be here today, Jean, and share a little bit of your story. I also want to reiterate that there is no right or wrong way to experience grief, and the grieving process is a different experience for everyone. This is Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. Today, we have been talking about health, healing, and the role that the outdoors and being active plays in all of that. In this segment, I am joined by Sarah Rotman to talk about these things from the perspective of another healthcare provider, as well as talk a little bit about how Sarah's athletic endeavors have been derailed by health issues and how she's navigating getting back into sports and how her perspective has changed throughout this process. Thanks for being here today, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sarah is just finishing up her master's degree at UAA and will soon be a psychiatric nurse practitioner. So let's first talk about the outdoors and physical activity from a healthcare perspective. Why is our connection to nature and the outdoors so important for our health?
Well, humans naturally have a biological need to connect with nature, and this connection affects our well-being, productivity, and relationships. In the early 1980s, biologist and theorist Edward O. Wilson developed the biophilia hypothesis, which suggests that humans possess an innate tendency to seek connection with nature and other forms of life. He coined the term biophilia, which he described as the urge to affiliate with other forms of life. From an evolutionary perspective, humans have a deep-seated connection with nature. As a species, we've been evolving for more than 2 million years, yet we've lived relatively sheltered only from nature for the last about 10,000 years, which is really not a lot of time for selective genetic changes to occur. So essentially, we've gone from this life of living outdoors as hunter-gatherers to a rather sedentary indoor lifestyle in a relatively short period of time. There's evidence-based studies that support that being outside in nature actually changes our brain. In my first semester of graduate school, we were given an assignment about conducting self-care. And one of the options for the assignment was to take a walk in nature and record our thoughts and feelings about it. I was really swamped with school that semester. I was teaching in the UAA nursing program and working a full-time night shift job as a nurse. So I probably had not been outdoors for weeks. I went ahead and took advantage of the assignment and went for a walk at Kincaid Park one night. I pretty much lived at Kincaid growing up, so it was nothing new to me. Yet, through this assignment, I was seeing, the outdoors and nature through a completely different perspective. I had not had this connection with nature in a while, and I found myself feeling so in awe of everything from the light to the colors to the earthy smells out on the trails, and really got lucky and got to see a bunch of animals. And I could already just see there my, mental health lifting.
I'm really glad that they gave you that assignment. That seems pretty, some pretty good foresight on their part.
It was really interesting.
I think that it's also so interesting that there's this strong connection between nature and physical health and nature, physical activity and health. And yet we take people who are sick and stick them in buildings and rooms that have no windows and zero connection to nature. I don't really have a good solution about how to fix that, but it seems like we should probably make that more of a priority. I know that some architecture people and people that design hospitals and mental institutions are more aware of that these days and are focused specifically on that, but I just don't think that it's extremely prevalent. We all know that physical activity is important for physical health, as we've talked about, but how does it directly impact our mental health?
Well, the impact of physical activity on our mental health has been found to be significant. This is one of my favorite topics to research, too. I'm really fascinated by the neurobiological research that continues to come out. Exercise or physical activity affects our brains on a chemical and cellular level. There's so much more to the simple theory that it increases endorphins, or also our feel-good hormones, which is true, but there's actually a lot more going on in our brains when we're exposed to regular physical activity. So to put it simply, exercise directly affects the brain by increasing the supply of blood, which improves the delivery of oxygen and nutrients. This increased supply of oxygen and nutrients then improves neuronal health. And neurons are the connecting cells in our brains. And the brain is made up of approximately 100 billion neurons. So they're playing a very important role. And regular exercise has been found to increase the volume of certain brain regions. And of critical importance for mental health is the region in our brain of the which is called the hippocampus. And that's an area of the brain that's involved in memory, emotional regulation, and learning. And animal studies have shown convincing evidence that exercise leads to the creation of more hippocampal neurons, known as neurogenesis. So with preliminary evidence, since these have been done in animal studies, that preliminary evidence suggests that this would also be true in humans. So you are theoretically actually changing your brain and increasing the volume by regular exercise. And we know in the mental health world that disorders such as schizophrenia and Alzheimer's disease involves volume loss of the brain. So exercise can have a significant impact on improving disorders such as these.
I think that that's an interesting perspective, like getting some actual science behind why we actually feel good and are nicer to each other. Our mood is better. We mm-hmm. have better behavior when we exercise.
Correct.
That sometimes is so hard to remember how much better you feel once you get out and exercise. Even if you don't suffer from any sort of mental health disorder, it can be a mood booster, even though you don't feel like going. And I've never been sad that I went out and exercised. I've never gotten back from any sort of workout and thought, oh gosh, I really wish I hadn't gone to do that. I read an article about a month or so ago about how doctors in the UK have started writing prescriptions for nature for their patients. It sounds like they've actually got a whole program going to encourage people to get outside. And they even have a nature prescription calendar, which we will link to in the post for this show on the website, where there's a whole list of suggested activities that you can do outside each month. And I know that a lot of people are really excited about working out in a gym, but I have also found that that tends to get in the way of creating a consistent routine. They think that since they're at the gym, they need to be there for an hour to make it worthwhile, but then they only do that once or twice a week. I always suggest that people try to do shorter sessions more consistently, and I almost always recommend getting outside instead of going to the gym. Certainly, you could do both. But these days, when we're all so busy, being efficient is important. So getting your exercise and your outside time all at the same time is more bang for your buck and cheaper because you don't have to pay for the gym. There's also an interesting connection between sun avoidance and overall health. The typical recommendation is to limit sun exposure to reduce rates of skin cancer. But I know that there have been studies done comparing vitamin D supplementation and those who have adequate vitamin D levels from plenty of sun exposure. And they found that people who make their vitamin D from the sun are healthier overall and actually have lower rates of certain types of skin cancer, which leads to the conclusion that the sun itself and not just the vitamin D is partially responsible for some of these improved outcomes. Obviously, getting sunburned is bad, but the research urges a shift in recommendations from sun avoidance to encouraging what they call non-burning sun exposure. And sun exposure is also really important for regulating your circadian rhythm, so your sleep and wake cycle. So what about the role that physical activity and connection to nature plays in overcoming addiction and substance abuse?
So addiction and substance abuse are a huge problem in the U.S. today. It's estimated that 20.3 million adults in the U.S. have a substance abuse disorder, and approximately 7.7 million of those adults also have a co-occurring mental health disorder. And using exercise and fitness as a tool in addiction and substance abuse recovery could potentially go a long way with decreasing these addiction statistics. Many drug and addiction recovery centers today recognize this and incorporate exercise and fitness into their recovery programs. Much like the high of substance use, physical activity releases endorphins and creates that feeling of euphoria. Although the high might not be as intense as using drugs or alcohol, physical activity can help with the addiction and cravings of substance use. And exercise builds physical strength, of course, but it can also regulate brain chemistry, provide a distraction from cravings, improve sleep quality, and aid digestion. Exercise has been proposed as an effective relapse prevention intervention, specifically due to the potential number of positive physiological and psychological benefits, which include improved mood, regulated reward systems, reduced depressive symptoms, improved sleep and cognitive function. And all these may serve to risk for relapse potential.
I also think that it's important to maybe not replace one addiction with another, even though exercise is certainly a healthy addiction.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, we all know those people who definitely are addicted to exercise, which, again, has its benefits. But I think that if you are struggling with substance abuse or any sort of addiction problem, it's important to address the core of that for sure, while also using exercise, but not replacing one with another.
Right.
Social media has been something that has come up on this show several times, and it's certainly a big deal these days. When it comes to mental health issues, social media can either feel really isolating because of the stigma associated with mental health disorders, or it can be a place for people to connect and find others who understand what they're going through. What are your thoughts about social media making people feel more isolated versus maybe more connected?
I've personally done some browsing around on social media sites, specifically Facebook, and I've found lots of these groups that you can join that have to do with connecting with people with mental health problems, you know, either for themselves or for family members or friends or their children. And for the most part, it seems like they're pretty helpful. I tend to cringe sometimes with some of the advice people are giving each other when they're not, you know, professional in the field. But I can see that they're definitely trying to help one another. So, you know, in that sense, it can be possibly dangerous depending on if people are taking that advice. But I think for the most part, people are trying to be pretty supportive. And I've been pretty impressed with a lot of these groups.
I also think that I agree with you about giving advice, getting medical advice from the internet. I see that a lot too in my just in my time online. I understand people need the connection to understand or to connect with others who are feeling the same thing or experiencing the same thing. For me, I see a lot of people who are struggling with their health and aren't getting the answers that they want from their doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But then they say, someone will say, oh, just take this supplement and you'll be fine. And that can be really extremely dangerous if you're getting health advice from somebody who has zero health experience
right.
other than their own health. So I think that always makes me cringe. But certainly I think as a place to connect with other people, it's great. I also think that sometimes it can be not so great when you like it's a highlight reel, like things like Instagram, which we, you know, is fairly new, but it tends to be more of a highlight reel and can actually make people feel like they're not doing enough or they're not good enough or, you know, they're not skinny enough or fit
mm-hmm.
enough. And I think that's frustrating. But I would agree that overall it's a great place to connect with people who are just struggling with the same things that you are.
Yeah. And especially I think some of the groups that are like, you know, moms with a child with a certain disorder. Yeah.
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about your athletic career and how your focus has changed as you've dealt with some health issues. So you grew up participating in sports, is that correct?
Yes. So my parents had me out ice skating and cross-country skiing from the time I could walk. And when I was in preschool, like starting around 3 years old, my dad took me on these 1 mile walks every every evening. And I remember that being like one of my favorite parts of the day. And I just absolutely loved going to the end of the block and looking over the bluff at Ocean View and seeing the inlet and the sunset and all the animals, all the birds down there. And I actually didn't know that these evening walks also served a purpose for my parents, which was calming me down before bed, because otherwise I was up dancing all night long to my Michael Jackson Thriller tape, since it was the 80s. And then when I started grade school, my parents gave me three choices of sports to participate in. They said speed skating, figure skating, or cross-country skiing, which we now call Nordic skiing. And I remember immediately saying figure skating and my mom saying cross-country skiing it is. So that winter, my parents signed me up for the Anchorage Junior Nordic League. And to this day, I am so thankful and grateful to my parents for putting me in this sport. I not only learned a healthy activity I can participate in for life, but I also had priceless experiences and made lifelong friends with my teammates and coaches. And I cannot say enough positive things about growing up in the Nordic community in Alaska.
I would have to agree with you. I also cross-country skied from the time that I could walk, but never junior Nordic. It was junior high school before I ski raced. But I have constantly been impressed with the quality of people that I met through cross-country skiing and cross-country running, quite honestly. I've never met people, I'm still friends with most of them, and I've never met people like that anywhere else. When I got to college, I was like, why are all these people not as great as all of my friends from high school? So you were a pretty competitive skier in high school and college. Can you talk about why you stopped skiing?
Yeah, so Nordic ski racing defined me in high school and college. It was my identity. It was my passion and my one effective way of coping. So being in college, I was just drowning in schoolwork and stress. And on the ski team, we were traveling frequently out of state. So as an athlete and student, you had to really be self-disciplined to study and get assignments done. And I just couldn't keep up. I didn't understand how to study or stay organized or take tests. And I had always struggled with reading, so especially textbook information and writing. I also had some really intense stressors in my personal life that I wasn't coping well with. And going into my third year of collegiate skiing, everything just finally collapsed and I found myself no longer on the ski team. And to say I was devastated was an understatement. I felt like I had lost everything that mattered to me. I didn't know who I was without skiing, and I didn't know how to live a healthy lifestyle without ski racing and training.
What was it like to go from having a really super structured workout routine to not having anything, really?
I was completely lost and just all over the place. Without those structured workouts and racing goals, I didn't know what to do. And I had relied so heavily on my coaches and teammates to guide me and support me. And I just really felt like I didn't have anybody. And the thought of trying to go work out by myself for the sake of just working out seemed pointless. I didn't know how to just go out and exercise. I had always thrived on having goals for racing, and I absolutely loved racing. And I loved the physical and emotional release of energy that I got from training and racing. And I couldn't figure myself out and ended up spending years of just being unhealthy and not being active or eating right. And my mental health really spiraled downhill. I thought I was going to have to go through life always regretting and mourning the loss of ski racing. I tried to get back into the ski community by coaches in high school, and I had some wonderful experiences. The kids were great to work with, but it was also a trigger for my loss of my own skiing career. So I just continued to feel sad and empty. And even after I was able to make it through nursing school, it was such a struggle for me to get through the schoolwork that it just didn't feel right. And it didn't give me a sense of identity like ski racing did. And I just was never able to feel proud of myself for having a degree and a career. So I still identified as a skier and not a nurse, even though I'd been out of skiing for years. The longer I was in this mindset, the more I beat myself up and abused my body. And because I struggled so much to get through nursing school, I just never felt like it was much of an achievement. I just assumed it was probably an easy degree anyone could get through.
Definitely not an easy degree that anyone can get through.
Good to
know. How have your views on the purpose of exercise and your athletic goals changed as you've really started getting back into a more regular workout routine?
I've known since I was a little kid that it was important to exercise. My parents were really active and always had my sister and I outside from the time we were born. However, even though I grew up with a really healthy, active lifestyle, I felt as if I almost didn't deserve to have the enjoyment of exercise and being healthy. I wasn't an athlete anymore, so I felt like, why should I feel good? You know, why should I even be healthy? And I was just really hard on myself. And it was not until recently, just within the last 2.5 years, that I had an absolutely life-changing experience, which allowed me to develop a new sense of identity and a sense of self-worth and develop some self-esteem. And I had never even experienced the feeling of what it was to like yourself until about 2 years ago. I just felt like I was trapped with this person that I was never going to like and just had to live with it. Now that I'm 37 and just starting to understand how my brain works and why I'm different, I found that I need structure and routine in my life. I also need physical exercise to keep me balanced and to channel that energy I naturally have. I don't necessarily need to race, although I still miss it, but I don't need to beat myself up for not being a racer.
I think it's really interesting that you said that you are no longer an athlete. I can't remember the name of the book, but there is a book about that talks about like the mindset of athletes having a good mindset for how you approach being active in competition. And one of the things that they ask is, do you identify yourself as an athlete? This is more, I think it's more geared towards more recreational, you know, athletes, people that are not going out to win things necessarily.
Right.
And the question of, I had this discussion with a friend of whether or not she identified it as an athlete. She's, you know, a triathlete. She's very active, but she does not identify as an athlete. Whereas I have no hesitation about saying, yes, I identify as an athlete because I'm active. And I think doing sports growing up maybe changes some of that. But I think it's interesting that you mentioned that I would say that just because you don't race anymore competitively doesn't mean that you're not still an athlete.
Well, that's that whole black and white thinking that I had always struggled with.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. So how has your personal experience with all of this played a role in you becoming a psychiatric nurse practitioner?
Well, as I said, about 2.5 years ago, I had a completely life-changing experience, and I was finally diagnosed with ADHD, the hyperactive type, which I had suspected for many, many years, but I was usually told to just go exercise, which I was doing that every day, so I wasn't really sure how much more exercise I could do. But ADHD is a cognitive disorder, and it absolutely explains a lot about me. I've pretty much just felt like I've been this stranger in my body my whole life, and now I understand my behaviors, my struggles in school, why everything sparkly distracted me, why I could stay up all night long dancing to techno music, which I still like doing, why I could drink so much coffee and just go to sleep. There's so many fascinating things about this disorder, and I'm just really enjoying discovering things about myself. But I also have been interested in the field of psychiatry and psychology since I was pretty young. And I absolutely love being a nurse, but after all these years of doing bedside care, I just didn't feel like I was being intellectually challenged enough. So after learning I had ADHD and started figuring out how my brain works, and that I'm actually not stupid, I just have a different way of learning things. So I felt like I was ready to take on school again. So I applied to go back for my master's and got accepted into the psychiatric nurse practitioner program at UAA. So now I'm about to graduate and I'm feeling pretty proud. And I feel like earning this degree and advancing my nursing career has become the new identity I needed to create for myself. And I already had so much empathy for my patients and my mental health patients, but I also now have this personal perspective struggle, so I'm really able to help them from, you know, a different level.
I think that as much as we try to remain objective as healthcare providers, I actually believe that our personal experiences bring a lot to the table in how we relate to and connect with patients in similar situations. from a patient perspective, I certainly appreciate it when my healthcare provider understands where I'm coming from. Part of my story is that when I was dealing with my own health issues, I was told by multiple healthcare providers to just stop running, and that would solve my fatigue issues. And while that certainly might have played a role, it was pretty discouraging to be told to stop doing something that I really loved. So, and not being given any further instructions or suggestions about what to do to feel better.
Right.
So that's definitely something that I've carried into my own interactions with patients. And I don't think that I've ever told anyone to stop exercising. So thank you so much for being here, Sarah. It's been really great talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show. Today we heard from Leslie Mead about how she uses exercise to manage her chronic lung disease and how she's able to go on many adventures, do triathlons, and run marathons, all while juggling her medication routine. We heard from Jean Moran about some of the adventures she had with her husband Ron, who she lost last year, and how nature and the outdoors and her community has played a role in her grieving process. And finally, we heard from Sarah Rotman about some of the science behind why nature and physical activity isn't just for physical health, but also great for your mood and mental health, and how she's had to find a new identity as she was faced with the challenge of no longer being a competitive Nordic skier, which is something that defined her life for many years. Thank you again to all our guests for talking with us today. Thank you to our producer, Eric Bork. I'm Martha Rosenstein, and from all the hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.